Today I was asked to give a tutorial talk, actually by Carl, and I thought I'd take the opportunity to go through some things that I often sort of touch upon when I give talks on the subject of quantum computing, but I think I'll expand on it a little bit today. I'm going to talk about a set of interrelated results that have come out in the last couple of years that give an interesting picture for alternatives for how we can approach the problem of doing quantum computation. And I've unified them a little bit broadly, maybe over broadly, under this category of teleportation. So I'm going to be talking about methods of quantum computing that use ideas from teleportation more or less explicitly. And I'll talk about how that differs from the sort of standard model of quantum computing. Well, let me give you an outline. So I'll first review what teleportation is. Many of you went to the talk in this series last week by Bill Wooters, and well, those of you who were won't need much of this introduction. Actually, what I will do is Bill Wooters posed a question to the audience that he actually never answered. So I'm going to answer the question. I don't know how many of you remember his question. I'll come to it in a moment. It's sort of a question of where has the quantum information gone, and I'll tell you where it's gone. Then I'll go through a little bit, I'll work in early in this discussion what I mean by the standard quantum computation model in order that I can contrast this with the various other techniques that have been coming along. And this chart up above will get filled in during the course of this lecture if I'm sufficiently coordinated to be pulling it down at the right moments. Then, as I say, I'll spend most of the time talking about quantum computation by these alternative methods. I can say it's really quantum computation by measurement. The key idea is that unlike, in fact, in the standard model of quantum computation, measurement plays an essential role in carrying the computation forward. And I will touch upon, as I said, there are about four different works that have come out in the last couple of years that I'll review in detail. They're all somewhat different from each other. I'll try to relate them to one another. When I agreed to give this talk, I actually didn't realize that several of the people who did this work would be in the audience, so the real experts are sitting in the audience, like Mike Nielsen and Debbie Leung. And so, well, you know, I'll have ample opportunity for correction if I go off track on this tutorial. Okay, so let me go back to the basics of teleportation. And as I said, what I'm about to say is no different from what Bill Wooters mentioned last week. Teleportation solves a task, which is to move a state around, move a quantum state around. So you have a system, let's say a spin. In many cases in this discussion, when I say a quantum state or a qubit, think spin if you want to have a physical picture. So I have a spin in a certain quantum state, which I'll label phi. And it's in this part of the world, we often say Alice and Bob. I won't say this very much during this talk. Some stuff is supposed to take place, and at the end of the day, the state is supposed to appear to be embodied in a spin that's on Bob's side of the world. Now, and the rules are that, in a sense, as little is supposed to pass from Alice to Bob as possible to cause this to happen. But the specific scenario we have in mind is that Alice and Bob will have already in the past shared an entangled state. We often draw this little symbol to indicate, you know, it's sort of the picture of a down conversion or something like that. But they've shared an EPR pair. They've shared a maximally entangled state. And I'll take it to be the particular state, to use qubit notation, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. Equivalent, essentially, to the EPR singlet. Now, the scheme of teleportation is that this state transfer is accomplished not by carrying the particle from place to place, nor by producing an interaction between Alice and Bob, but rather by doing a measurement, the so-called Bell measurement, obtaining an output. Well, let me say what the Bell measurement is, first of all. The Bell measurement is a particular von Neumann measurement, a projective measurement, in the following basis. Let me give this a symbol, which I'll use occasionally during the talk. Phi plus, we often use as the notation for this state. So the Bell measurement is a measurement in a complete orthogonal basis, one of which, one of the basis states is the state I've just used, that entangled state. And the others are a set of other maximally entangled states which are orthogonal to the first, orthogonal all to each other, I should say. So 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 0, 1, plus 1, 0, and then 0, 1, minus 1, 0. I want to note that these states are simply related to the first state, the sort of canonical maximally entangled state, by a simple rotation, which I'll write this way, identity times sigma z on the first state, phi plus. This indicates that this is a rotation of the state which does not act on the first spin, but does act on the second spin according to this particular Pauli matrix operator, sigma z. And then the same for the others. This one is sigma x, and this one's sigma y. So all three Pauli matrices come in. So so you do a measurement in this basis, and you get one of these four outcomes. And the rule for obtaining the desired effect, getting phi to appear on this in this state, is to do nothing if the outcome of the state is phi plus, and if it's something else, to do the appropriate rotation on the state, sigma I, where this Pauli matrix rotation, this unitary rotation of this spin, is the same, is identified by this table. That is, you rotate by sigma z if the outcome of the measurement is this state, by sigma x if it's this measurement, if it's this state, and sigma y if it's that measurement. So that's teleportation. Now I wanted to, as I said, I wanted to talk about the question that Bill Hooters raised when he lectured on this last week, which is, at this point in time, I mean, this is, you tend to think of this as a time axis, you know, first this process occurs, then the measurement outcome is obtained and sent to Bob, and then Bob performs this rotation. At this moment, what has happened to this state phi? That was the puzzle that Bill raised, because he pointed out that the this outcome, whether you get this state, this state, this state, or this state, is completely uncorrelated with the state phi. It's the probabilities of outcomes are uncorrelated with this. In fact, they're all equally likely. They all have a quarter probability of occurring, no matter what the state phi is. And it's clearly not embodied in this state either, because this state hasn't been touched yet. It's still just half of this EPR pair. So the state seems to have gone away. It seems to have vanished, but yet it is re-embodied finally at the end. Now, the answer to Bill's question, you know, I don't know if anyone in the audience took a stab at the answer for themselves. The answer is that the state is still there, and it's embodied in the remaining entanglement between this particle and this other information. So let me write down a state which describes the state of the whole world in a sense at this moment to illustrate where this state has gone. It's gone a long way. That is, it's been sent out into the world. It's by some conventional measure very much decohered. Let me use yet another notation, it'll just simplify things. These are four outcomes of a measurement, so I'll label them 1, 2, 3, 4. Just a matter of labeling. Let me also take a particular spin state, I'll write it in qubit language, A0 plus B1. Just so I can write down what this state is. And actually, Wouters wrote down this state, but I'll write it down again and make the point. So the state, I'll write a big psi because it indicates, you know, the state of a rather large object at this point in the evolution, is outcome one. So this will be the outcome, which I'll still write in quantum mechanical notation, times this very state that I've written here, A0 plus B1 plus, let me see if I can squeeze them all in here, 2, 3, 4. And, you know, the rule for teleportation says that this state, now this is the, this part is the state of the Bob particle. So for this one, there's a modified state that appears here. Here the coefficients get flipped. And here you get the flipping and the sign change. Now this is just simple arithmetic to show that this is true, but as I say, there's a real weirdness to this in the sense that indeed nothing, Bob really doesn't have anything of this state yet, despite the way this looks, because if I trace out the outcome, Bob has a completely mixed state. So if Bob is supposed to have this particle, it's supposed to have this qubit state. It's certainly in a completely decohered form at the moment. So it's correlated or it's entangled. Bob's state is entangled with the outcome, which is itself a macroscopic variable at this point. That is, it's a measurement record. You know, the measuring apparatus has produced some record, and it's been published in the newspaper. So this is representing an enormous number of copies, let's say, of this record, this outcome record. So the state. You know, so the state at this point, we often think that the way to get a pure quantum state, or to have a pure quantum state, is to have a spin carefully isolated in some apparatus, in a refrigerator, and shielding it from magnetic fields, and, you know, carefully guarding it from being touched by the environment. And yet here, the environment's all over it. So as I say, the system is very much decohered. It's the state phi only exists in this very diffused form at this point. Nevertheless, because of the particular type of entanglement that has appeared between system and environment, one simple operation can completely undo it again, can completely restore the coherence of this state somewhere else. So these are all commonplaces in a sense. I mean, I've just told you the message of the 1993 paper on this, but I think it's a remarkable message that coherence doesn't necessarily mean perfect isolation, and that if a system decoheres, it doesn't always mean that that's an irreversible effect. And it's really these messages of teleportation that have come up in these more recent applications, which show that, again, that perfect coherence or coherent evolution is not necessary for the performance of quantum computation. So let me go to my first application. First to set it up, and then I'm gonna come to my chart and fill in a few of the blanks. Let's see. So we're gonna try a new trick, sort of based on this idea, or based on this observation that you can do this decohering and recohering with the right sequence of measurement and rotation. And we're going to try to use it to simplify certain things that take place in quantum computation. So in standard quantum computation, there will be occasions when you want to take two qubits. I don't know if I need any labels for these, but, well, there's qubit 1 and there's qubit 2. And I want to, you know, they're in some state. They don't have to be in particular pure states, but I'll label them as such for the moment. An important thing that's supposed to happen to them is they're supposed to undergo some particular coherent time evolution. For example, something which we symbolize this way, a controlled knot. I'll say a few words more about that. This is some unitary transformation. I'll call it U sub C naught. And it's supposed to get applied to the initial state, phi 1, phi 2. So that's supposed to be the outcome of this. Now, let me say a few words about what a C naught is in more physical language. A C naught is, well, first of all, it's one way of describing it, it's a mapping of the state space of these two qubits, which consists of these four basis functions, 0, 0 through 1, 1. The first two are unchanged, and the second two are interchanged, or the last two are interchanged. This goes to 1, 1. This goes to 1, 0. Now, in physics, we like to describe these things as being produced by the effect of some Hamiltonian. And so a Hamiltonian that will do this for a spin system, which I'll label H2, and that'll start to connect with what I have up there, is some Hamiltonian, which in this simple example, in this particular example, is going to be something which is a sigma z operator on the first qubit, and a sigma, if I'm not mistaken, x on the second qubit. So a Hamiltonian of this sort is needed, you might say, or it might appear, to obtain this. And in the standard model, or in the standard way of thinking, we've envisioned getting this by, first of all, imagining that we have an apparatus in which we have such couplings, and the strength of these couplings are time dependent in a manner that's controllable externally. So that you have some exchange coupling J Z X between spins 1 and 2, which can be varied as a function of time. So you can have it be 0 up to some time, and then turn it on, and then turn it off again. And then it will be the unitary operator will be given by the exponential. I may have to time order it if I have some peculiar situation. Integral of h of t dt with an I here. So in other words, the propagator obtained by this particular time-dependent Hamiltonian is supposed to produce this mapping. So that's the standard picture, and it's the standard picture that I'm trying to get away from with this picture, the standard picture saying I have to take these spins and put them in very cold refrigerators and never let them touch anything else in the whole world except each other. So I want them to interact with each other in a very carefully designed and controlled way. That may be the way to go in the end. We really don't know at the moment, and people are working hard to make such devices. But there's another way to go, which involves this massive decoherence and then recoherence. So let me talk about what's been done for the C-naught. I was going to digress for a moment, but, well, let me just make the statement. I don't know how many people know why we focus on the C-naught. It's somewhat of a historical accident, I would say. But the fact is that if you have as a toolkit the C-naught plus the ability to do one-bit rotations, one-qubit rotations, which I can symbolize something like this. That is, a qubit comes in, it gets rotated in some fashion, and you need a certain repertoire of these unitary rotations. Not all possible unitary rotations are necessary, but a certain repertoire of them are necessary, like rotations around two different axes. So you might want a Hamiltonian which has couplings to the spins by sigma x and by sigma z, say. And time variable couplings of those are sufficient to do all quantum computations. That's a universality theorem of quantum computation. I was thinking of getting into why this particular choice, and maybe I'll just leave it to say that this is not the only possible choice, but it's just one that is convenient for many points of view. I think I'll leave it at that. So I won't motivate any further why we focus on the C-naught as the thing to try. So let me give you the scheme. So this is going to be Gottesman and Chuang. And let's see, I have I have references here and there. In the modern spirit, I'm going to refer to these only in this manner and leave it to the interested person to figure out or to find out where it actually is. This is the quant pH number in all cases at Los Alamos. All these papers are all published also, but you know, why should we bother about such insignificant facts? Anyway, what they set out to do, or one of the things that they set out to do, was to indeed do this replacement to see if you could do a C-naught in the following manner. So here's qubit 1, and here's qubit 2. And so instead of having some Hamiltonian interaction between them, I'm going to imagine that there is some prior entanglement available. And maybe it's going to be phi plus, but I'm going to put this in quotation marks. There's going to be some standard entangled state. It actually won't be exactly phi plus, but it'll be something close to it, something I obtained from it by a simple transformation. It'll be a fixed state, that's important to say. That is, it's independent of the state of the qubits that are being put into this box. And now we're going to try to do the C-naught by never having any direct interaction, you know, between the Alice part and the Bob part, but we will imagine doing some stuff like measurements and some communication. Let's see, I symbolized that with sort of double lines before. Some communication, perhaps, back and forth, because the outcomes of these measurements need to be known. And then possibly some correction steps. And that's it. That's the sort of general scheme that that we're shooting for. Now, the this desired outcome can indeed be achieved by something that's actually pretty close to this original teleportation circuit. So it's a real it's lucky that I didn't erase it. Let me erase, however, this stuff. So I'll give you a pictorial. I'll give you a picture of how they made this work, and then I'll discuss why it works. So I'm going to turn this picture around a little bit, put both of the qubits up above, and put the entangled states down below. So I have here qubit 1 comes in, and qubit 2. And we're going to have some entangled states, and actually we're going to have two of them. So we're going to have two phi pluses, and now I really mean phi plus, the very same state that I had here. But I'm going to do something else to them before I use them further. This is not yet the standard entangled state that I want. I'm going to do this. Now, you can say, well, I'm cheating in a sense. I mean, I'm using the C-naught already. The idea is, though, that I'm only using it in a state synthesis. So that is, this picture you should view as just an instruction for the synthesis of a particular entangled state. And it's up to you how to figure out how to get that state. You may not it may not be necessary to get it by this means, but this will define what it is. It's this particular unitary transformation applied to the halves of two EPR pairs. The idea of this is that you're trying to, in a sense, kind of pre-compute the C-naught. That is, this can be done long in the past. Now, you don't know when you're actually going to have to do a C-naught on some unknown qubit states, but you're going to get something ready. You're going to do a lot of C-naughts ahead of time and put them in the bank for this use. So that, if that helps you, keep that thought in mind. Okay, now what do you do? So now we're going to do some measurements. And in fact, it's going to be precisely this Bell measurement that gets done. But I have to do it twice, because I will do it first on qubit 2 and 1 of these particles, and then an underpass indicated here. I'll do it again here. So there are two Bell measurements, two projective measurements into this maximally entangled basis. And now, the idea is that at least part of the time we're done, as in this, just as in ordinary teleportation. That is, if I happen to get the right outcome, the phi plus outcome of this projective measurement, I don't have to do anything. At that point, the state of this particle is in the desired state. Likewise here, if I get both Bell projections go into phi plus, nothing has to be done. This pair of particles is the C-naught of this pair. That is just what I've indicated here. It's that particular unitary transformation. Now, that only happens 1/16th of the time, a quarter for this and a quarter for this. But all the other cases are correctable. I'll give you the sketch picture just to give you a sense of what kind of corrections need to be done to make this work. And I'm just pulling this out of the paper. So you get this classical output here. You can think of it as being two different bits. There are four outcomes encodable in two bits. So you take one of the bits, and if it's a one, if that bit is a one, you do an x rotation. Well, I should say sigma x rotation on each of these. You take the other bit, and you do a z rotation on one of the particles. Then you take the bits from the other box, the other measurement, and you do some similar stuff. Let's see, you do a sigma x with one of the bits, and you do a sigma z on both of them with the other bit. This part's not so interesting, I would say, but it's just to say that there is a prescription for doing this, which is a little more intricate than this, but still straightforward. And this is what it is, in fact. I haven't told you the conventions for all these, so you'd still have to go to the paper to sort that all out. Now, let me talk about the reason why this works, and perhaps what you've gained compared with the standard model of quantum computation. The reason why it works is that as I said, everything's fine when these come out to be the desired, you know, the phi plus state, because then when you get phi plus here, then conditioned upon that, the state here, this is where I wanted to actually got some colored chalk just for this purpose. When you get phi pluses here, that tells you that the state at this point in the diagram is identical to the state here. So that's the rule of teleportation, that when you get the right outcome, the state of these particles is simply moved down to here without anything wrong. And you notice I put it before the C-naught, so that the state is pushed down to here, the C-naught is done, and you've done what you want. So none of these corrections are needed. The problem is that when these are not phi pluses, then what happens is that some of these, depending on these outcomes, there's some rotation applied already, like sigma x, for example, is applied already before this C naught. So that's undesirable, because now we've got a circuit which is like this, sigma x, and then a C naught. Now, we'd like to somehow, what we're able to do is some other operations after the C naught, but not before. So, but the fortunate thing about the C naught is that the effect of this is always undoable, or is can be undone by things that you do afterwards. Another way of saying it is that it's possible to commute this sigma x through the C naught gate at the cost of turning it into something different. In fact, the rule, for example, here is, if I'm not mistaken, yes, the commutation rule for this particular example is that this turns into a sigma x on both qubits. And there's a similar commutation rule for a sigma x appearing anywhere before here. That is, once you push it afterwards, it turns into other things which are just other sigma x's. And that's what all this stuff is cooked up to do. It's designed to use these commutation rules to do the right fixes after the these measurements. So that's doable, and so that provides another technique for doing quantum computation. So now I want to start using this table here, because the rest of my lecture will be showing how other uses of this strategy permit other capabilities to be used in used or not used in the course of quantum computation. So, I wanted to first put here ordinary teleportation. My various resources tabulated here. This one doesn't pretend to do full quantum computation, so it's going to be unlike all the other schemes that I'll mention here. The task of moving the qubit from one place to another doesn't require a direct two-body interaction between Alice and Bob. That's the point of teleportation. It does require a programmable one-bit rotation, because that's the final sigma x or sigma Pauli rotation. it does involve a particular multi-qubit projection operator, namely this Bell measurement. It doesn't require single qubit projections. That's going to be used somewhere later in this table. And it certainly, obviously, uses prior entanglement. Now, this is to be contrasted somewhat with the standard model, standard quantum computation model. now we're into models that can give full computation. Those definitely do use coherent two-spin interactions throughout the course of computation. And usually, or in most models, we invoke controllable one-body interactions as well. We don't use these multi-qubit projectors. And one-qubit projectors are only used for output, or for other sort of ancillary purposes, but they're not sort of a core part of the standard model of quantum computation. And no prior entanglement is invoked. now, the thing that I've just reviewed for you, I want to contrast, you know, the set of resources that are used in the Gottesman and Chuang approach to quantum computation. It is a model that gives full quantum computation. That'll be true for the rest of this chart. It does not require any programmable, you know, time-programmable spin-spin interactions. And that's its principle. That was the principal benefit that we were looking for, that Gottesman and Chuang were looking for. They were intending to show that you don't need interactions to do quantum computation. You do need these one-bit rotations still. You again need the Bell projection, as in ordinary teleportation. There are no 1-bit projections invoked, well, except for output, I guess. And certainly prior entanglement is needed, and it's of this complex form. This was this sort of EPR pair, and now we need sort of this pre-computed entanglement. Yeah.
There's this important difference between having programmable interactions between two people and being able to do multi-qubit projections.
Mm-hmm.
And naively, I would think they are very similar and almost, similarly difficult.
Okay.
Because both involve entanglement, two qubits.
Yeah, well, I guess you can. This is part of the discussion of, what is a Bell measurement? Doesn't it, if you peel back the box of the Bell measurement, isn't there really interaction going on in there? I think that's a fair criticism, although, and if that were the end of the story, you'd say, well, you know, this is maybe not such an interesting trade-off. But I think the other ones that have been introduced, at least make this trade-off more intricate. I would also point out that things like the, say, for example, the accuracy requirements or the coherence requirements of the process itself, you know, you would expect to be different for the performance of a Bell measurement compared with, you know, the performance of an entangling Hamiltonian operation. So you're supposed to think that these are different. I'm not going to say that these are better. It's just that we don't know which of these may eventually be better in the laboratory. It's at least worthwhile to know that there are very, very different approaches in the laboratory for doing quantum computation. But I agree with you that the Bell measurement sounds a lot like an interaction. And I'm going to review briefly Manny's work, in which I point out that at least in some sense you can get Bell measurements without any interactions, which is kind of a surprise, but you know, it works in that particular setting. Jumping ahead for the expert. All right, so in the remainder of my lecture, I just want to introduce three other pieces of work. None of this is my work, I should say, which has sort of added to the intricacy or complexity or interest of these different trade-offs, and has shown that there really are a variety of different ways of doing essentially this, of doing this quantum computation task. So let me with apologies to Mike Nielsen, who's in the audience, I'm going to just give a little review of his work, see how well I do it. So I'm going to show how you get rid of this, actually. Show that actually these final correction steps aren't even needed if you take a somewhat different approach to the problem. I wonder if I can doctor this. Well, no, I'll just start over again. So now we're going to do Nielsen, and we're getting much more current here. 0, 1, 0, 8, 0, 20. So let me illustrate this for the case where I'm just going to illustrate it for one qubit, but it's just a matter of drawing more symbols to talk about it for two qubits. I'm going to talk about how you obtain some operation U on a qubit by a kind of teleportation scheme. So what Mike observes is the following, that you can do this by, again, cooking up a particular piece of prior entanglement, the right kind of pre-computed entanglement. This is what I want to do, that particular unitary transformation. So the tool I'm going to use to get it is to create a state which he calls UJ, which is equal to, I'll say a little more about this in a moment, 1 cross U times sigma J applied to phi plus. Now, we've already seen something like this. That is, if you take, these are the the three Pauli matrices and the identity. If U is the identity, then this is just this Bell basis. But this is, that is, you do apply these Pauli rotations to one half or one part of the phi plus. You can append another unitary transformation to the end, and that doesn't change the fact that this is, again, a basis of maximally entangled states. So I'm going to do I'm going to first create states, these states. I can create them by projection. So if I start with a pair of qubits, which are both in the zero state, and I do a projection into this U basis, UJ basis, then I get out one of the UJ states. I guess I should say I'm changing views a little bit. This is a non-destructive projection rather than the destructive projections that I've been describing up till now. By this means, by some other pre-computation means, you can say you obtain these UJs. And then you endeavor to teleport using these states rather than the usual EPR states. So I'm going to take this state, this UJ state. I don't care which J I get at the moment. That is, I'm going to get one of the four states at random by this projection, and that's not going to matter. I'll do a Bell measurement. This is now the ordinary Bell measurement. So I'm going to say the mapping from that diagram to this one. I do the Bell measurement, and I get some measurement outcome. I'll call it M. Now, what have I obtained? Well, if I look at what's happened here, I should do one replacement here to say that this is the same as, this is equal to, maybe I need to redraw this diagram. This is equal to something that looks even closer to standard teleportation, the Bell measurement. I have just the ordinary phi plus, but I've gotten a UJ, and the way that I can get that from a phi plus, according to that picture, is by applying U sigma J to here. So I've so these are mathematically equivalent, and I can use this now to say what will happen depending on what outcomes I get here. So suppose I get outcome J. That means that the state here is, this was state phi. The state at this point was sigma J times phi. And now I apply to it the operator U sigma J. Now sigma J squares to the identity, so that's U phi. So in that case, in the case where I get outcome J, the same outcome as I got from this UJ basis projector, then I've done the job. Then I actually have gotten U times U applied to phi. But 3/4 of the time, that doesn't happen. I get some other outcome, M, which is not equal to J. And so I get here, this was sigma M, and I've gotten an incorrect rotation of the state. I've gotten U times sigma J sigma M applied to phi. So I say, drat, I've screwed up. I haven't done the right thing. But the thing is to try again. So you've rotated the state, but you know how you've rotated it. You still want to rotate it by U, not by this blasted thing. So you try it again, except that this time you try rotating by some other U, U prime, which is equal to U times sigma M times sigma J times U dagger. So I try that one, but in other words, I do the same whole thing, except in here for U, I put in this thing. I know what M and J are because they were measurement outcomes. And if I succeed with this probability a quarter, then you see these things will just cancel off everything here. The U dagger will cancel the U, the sigma J will cancel the sigma J, the sigma M will cancel that, and I've gotten the right rotation. And so suppose I fail. Well, then I try it again with another U prime that has the form such that if it succeeds, it will rotate me right to where I want. So this is this try again, and after, on average about 4 tries, you will have done the job and gotten the desired rotation. So let me discuss what the resource view of this Nielsen scheme is, because it is somewhat different. It was cooked up to be somewhat different to show that there's yet a different mix of capabilities that will give you the same desired outcome. Again, it's a model that will give you full computation. It doesn't require any two-body interaction. Again, it doesn't even require any one-body interaction. That was in fact the point, that there's no Hamiltonian at all in this model, ever. Everything is only projections. So I do have these multi-qubit projectors, which are both Bell measurements and sort of modified Bell prime, because you have all these UJ projectors, which are sort of the same form as Bell measurements. They're 4 outcome measurements into a maximally entangled basis, but into appropriately rotated ones. And as I say, I haven't done the 2-qubit version of this, which goes in a similar, according to a similar story, but I actually need 4-qubit projectors, although now only 3-qubit projectors. So there are various technical things that are going on with this. Again, well, no particular need for 1-qubit projectors. Nielsen would say, well, in fact, we don't even need prior entanglement. I could have said that earlier. That is, if I have the capability of doing a multi-qubit projector, then I can use it to replace for the ability to have prior entanglement. I can make it with these projectors. It says these projectors are awfully powerful and probably hard to make in the laboratory. There's a new column here that I haven't used. Because there's another thing you sacrifice, which is that the system, procedure is not deterministic anymore. That is, there's some chance that it won't succeed. You keep trying and trying, and it just doesn't work. Of course, the probability that it works, approaches 1 exponentially as you go along. But some of the new other techniques also involve a loss of determinism, a certain probability that the computation will not work. And so there's another thing sacrificed here. But you notice that, really boiled this down to hardly anything. That is the only yes in this whole column is here, completely disjoint from the standard model. The standard model said nothing about projections, but it says everything about unitary transformations and so forth. So this looks totally different. It's a sort of philosophical point I wanted to make based on my discussion of teleportation is that, in some sense, these are not so different. There's still a unitary transformation going on, but it involves this larger world. It involves this apparent sort of entanglement with the larger world, the entanglement that comes from doing a measurement. But again, the lesson is that that's not necessarily destructive of the overall desire of having unitary mappings of states, from input to output. Now, actually, I've left myself hardly any time for the last couple of things. Let me skip to the last one. I'll fill in this whole table, but I'll spend hardly any time on Manny's results since he's not here. And discuss very briefly the work of Rausendorf and Bruegel, because I think it's really a very interesting variant on this. They have observed the following. I'm not going to motivate this. It takes a fair amount of work to show why this is true. They have a very kind of spin, kind of solid state language for describing what they've obtained. And I'll just retain their language, although you could also say it in kind of computer science language if you felt like. So imagine we have two-dimensional lattice. I'll draw a fair amount of it. This is just to sort of spatially locate the qubits in this construction. Qubits will be located at the crossings of this two-dimensional lattice. So I have a spin square spin lattice, you might say. Now, the first thing I do with this lattice is I prepare it in a certain entangled state. Now, it takes me a little work, or it's difficult to write down the entangled state explicitly, but I can I can tell you what properties it has. It is a particular state. They call it the cluster state. Oh, and I meant to always give the cryptic number. So R and B, top of the charts, 0010033. And I think that's their Fizeriv letter, and they have longer papers also. Okay, so they have a state which is highly entangled. It can be produced in one of two ways. It can be imagined as being obtained in one of two ways. One is to start the spins in all in an eigenstate of sigma x. So you always start the spin in this superposition 0 plus 1, every single spin in the lattice. That just means spin pointing in the x direction. And then you turn on couplings, which are just Ising couplings, sigma z, nearest neighbor couplings, on this lattice. So you have an H2, which is of this sigma z form, on the whole lattice. And you turn it on for a particular length of time, and then turn it off again. And then the system is frozen into a particular entangled state. Another way of describing this entangled state is it's actually the ground state of a particular Hamiltonian, which regrettably is a Hamiltonian involving five spin interactions. So there's a particular H5 in which, the easiest way is to describe it in this sort of star language, which involves a sigma x at the center site and sigma z's on the surrounding sites. And the state that they have in mind, this cluster state, is the ground state of that model. This is an indication this is one place in the lecture where this appears, but this is a very interesting issue that sometimes in quantum computation with five-body interactions or four-body interactions, you can get very useful states. That is, these interactions, if you could ever make them in the laboratory, say, or have an effective interaction of this form, you could get potentially great power in quantum computation. This cluster state has various properties. Like if you measure some block of spins, you don't disturb very much the entanglement of all the rest. And that's a fairly special property. You can write down simple entangled states that have just the opposite property. That if you measure a few of the spins, you completely destroy the entanglement of everything else in the lattice. I've given you a fairly implicit definition of the state that they obtain, but there's a particular prior entanglement that they need for this model. Then quantum computation proceeds in the following way. This is why this two-dimensional picture is useful. You have in mind some network of gates to perform, like say the C naught. The idea is you choose particular strips of qubits, of spins in this lattice to play the role of sort of the timelines of this qubit. So I'll choose that one for this, and that one for this. Then there's a particular sequence of measurements that I do. I do some measurement of these two spins. Actually, first I kind of knock out the middle row, mostly. I just do a standard measurement of these spins, so they're eliminated from the problem. Then these spins get measured in particular ways such that the outcomes of the projective measurements on these spins get fed forward to tell you the basis in which to do the measurements on succeeding spins. I'm sorry, I realize I don't have time to do justice to this, but there's a way of sort of hopping through this, doing successive measurements, and finally doing measurements on some joining spin, which takes care of the effect of the C-naught. And on you go. And they have a sort of modular model where doing this gate by gate is sufficient to do quantum computation. So this gives a somewhat different resource view. What's different here is again, computation basically proceeds by one qubit by projection only. But now it's only one qubit projection. There's not any multi-qubit projection. So I glance back to Riediger, because it says that there are some cases in which you can do this teleportation trick where if you have the right prior entangled state, you don't need even multi-qubit projections. There are no interactions left at all, because again, I fill in no. And the only hitch is that I need some rather peculiar type of prior entanglement, some kind of n-body prior entanglement. This was always like two-body or three-body or, you know, few-body prior entanglement before. Now there's a particular kind of condensed matter type entanglement that's needed. It's actually also deterministic, amazingly enough. I feel not enough work's been done on this model to really understand why it works. But I think it's a fascinating, you know, fact that this works. Well, I have run to the end of my hour. I was going to review Knill et al. Maybe I'll just fill in this this part of the table. Let's see, I'd have to look in my notes to get the quant pH number, but just look under Knill, Laflamme, and Milburn. I have a little bit of a hard time describing in this table, because this, unlike all the others, is not a qubit model. It's not a spin model. It's really a boson model. That is, the fundamental carriers of quantum information are bosonic modes, are harmonic oscillators, if you will, rather than qubits. So for here, rather than talk about two-spin and one-spin interactions, what they note is that they can do quantum computation with Hamiltonians which are only quadratic. In the boson operators, in the boson creation and annihilation operators. And that's peculiar because it sort of resembles the sort of H1. That is, we would call that a non-interacting boson system. Their power seems to obtain from the kind of projections they do, which are number state projections, which are still pretty simple, at least in principle. That is, you know, again, from this qubit point of view, it's sort of like just single qubit projectors. It's just projection into the eigenstate of the harmonic oscillator, which eigenstate of the harmonic oscillator, or how many photons in the mode. It doesn't actually require prior entanglement, but it does require this ability to prepare and manipulate number states. So it kind of requires prior squeezing rather than entanglement. It's also non-deterministic. And it also uses teleportation steps to very explicitly to make the scheme go. But I think I've said enough for today. So I hope this has been an entertaining story and gives you an idea that there's a pretty broad scope for approaches to quantum computation. That's all. Thanks.
We have time for the I was wondering if you could what happens if you look at the model where you have multi, you have Bell measurements, but of a restricted form, where you just imagine taking the space and partitioning it into two subspaces. One is, let's say, the singlet state, and then the other is the other.
The 1 and 3, okay. Now, of course, if you give me Pauli operators, then I can use that to make a full Bell measurement. Well, unless I do it destructively, okay, so there's several variants of that question. That is, whether the outcome is just classical data or whether it's the projected state itself. If it's this non-destructive sort, then I could, with rather modest additional resources, turn the model you just mentioned into the, you know, a model with full Bell measurement. But there are certainly variants, you know, in the question you've just posed where I don't know the answer, and it's certainly a kind of weakened version, and potentially an interesting one, because there are optics experiments where I guess they can actually do that, distinguish singlet from the rest. Actually, it really is tied up. There's some discussion of that actually in Knill et al, because they use those capabilities, and they're able to make it do full quantum computation. The one I know for which it's deficient in Rausendorf and Briegel, you have to do more work because the plane model as it is presented is not error tolerant. That is, you lose this n-body entanglement over time. And at least in the Bayer model, there's nothing to restore it. Now, they have a way of dealing with that, but it requires, in a sense, it requires bringing this back. You have to, at later stages of the computation, turn on the Ising coupling again to restore entanglement in the lattice. The rest, I think, conform to the standard model and therefore are accommodated by the usual stabilizer code error correction schemes. So there's no, except for this one, there's no fundamental difficulty. Plenty of practical difficulty.
Well, I think in this last scheme, this turning out of the Hamiltonian later on doesn't violate the spirit of this scheme and allows you to lay the cluster as you go along.
Yeah.
In some sense. So you don't have to start with a whole thing.
Yeah. Well, but I think, yes, that's true. But I'm actually remembering, I think what you also have to bring back is this. I think that you actually have to do some teleportation, basically, to bring yourself back into a fresh part of the lattice. And that requires now a 2-qubit projections. I'm not certain about that, but
I thought it was just conditional single-qubit measurements were enough, conditional upon the outcomes of the previous one.
You think even to deal with the decohering case?
Even to deal with the decohering case. Hmm.
Okay.
Because, I mean, other than that, they prove universality, and if they prove universality, presumably some of the strategies that one uses normally follow.
Well, it's a funny. Yeah, I don't know.
But much more should be done in this case.
So. We could look at the. I'd be curious if we can find a place in their paper where they've said that.